Are you ready to get started? We've got water, the bathroom, has everything they need. Thanks for coming. This is, I forget what I entitled this workshop, but basically this is a workshop about women, prison, and resistance from an abolitionist perspective. So I'm not necessarily going to talk about how to make like nicer, gentler, more humane, kind prisons for women, but like issues that affect women in prison and ways that we can work around improving these conditions and addressing their immediate needs while also keeping prison abolition, you know, sort of as our end goal. So like working on two fronts. So quick question before I start. Just by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Attica Rebellion? Attica Prison Rebellion. Okay. And how many of you have heard of the August Rebellion? So the Attica Rebellion happened in September 1971 at the maximum security men's prison called Attica, which is about 4 hours away from here. And the prisoners basically issued a series of demands for reforms. They wanted better living conditions. They wanted better working conditions. They wanted an end to working in the metal shop where temperatures rose to over 100 degrees and they still had to keep working through it. They wanted an end to the racist brutality and the racist treatment by prison staff, because it was an upstate prison where the staff was white, like mostly to all white, and the majority of people in prison then, as now, were mostly people of color. So it was mostly black and brown people from the New York City area. Also, I wanted to say, which I usually start, but I forgot, is that kid noises are welcome. You know, this is the sound of our movement growing, so nobody should be like giving, you know, like a mean eye to the kid if you can't hear. There's room over here, you know, so that you can hear me projecting this way. And you should not feel like you should have to walk out if your baby is making noise. So the prisoners at Attica rose up and they said, we want, you know, to basically be treated like humans, not as chattel. And they took 38 prison staff members hostage and they held the prison for 4 days. And they were mostly concentrated in the prison yard. And they demanded that then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York come and negotiate with them about their demands. And instead of negotiating with them, Rockefeller ordered the National Guard to come and fire tear gas into the yard and retake the prison by firing indiscriminately through the tear gas, which they could not see. And in the course of this, 31 prisoners and 9 guards were killed, and many, many others were wounded in the retaking of the prison and the brutality that happened afterwards. By prison staff members towards prisoners. And this is seen as sort of like this this turning point or this milestone in the history of the prison reform, prisoner rights movement. So suddenly like people were thinking about prison issues, radicals on the left, Puerto Rican liberation movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Women's Liberation Movement, all these other movements started seeing prison issues as something that they should be looking at and working towards and working in solidarity with. So Attica makes the history books when you're talking about prison rebellions, prison uprisings, and prisoner activism. 3 years later, at the women's maximum security prison, Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, which is actually about 40 minutes away from here, if you take the Metro North or if you drive. 3 years later, during the course of the prisoner rights movement being linked with the radical left movement, 5 male guards at Bedford Hills beat a prisoner organizer named Carol Crooks and placed her in segregation or solitary confinement without a hearing. And the month before that, Carol Crooks had won a court order stating that the prison was forbidden to place women in solitary confinement without any sort of due process. So women had to have a hearing, the prison had to tell them what the charges were, they were allowed to sort of argue, you know, against these charges and present their cases before the prison could place them in solitary confinement, which is basically like a small 6x9 cell that, you know, like that where they didn't have any human contact other than the guards. So this was obviously retaliation for Carol Crooks having won this lawsuit, that the guards beat her and placed her in solitary confinement. However, the women around her protested. They said, you know what, we've had enough of this. You know, why is it that when somebody wins a victory for us, she's beaten and she's placed in solitary confinement? Why are 5 male guards attacking this one woman? And they rioted. And they took over portions of the prison and they held 7 staff members hostage. And they held the prison until the state called in male state troopers and guards from neighboring male prisons to retake the prison. And during the course of this, 25 women were injured, and 24 women were transferred to the Mateo 1 complex for the criminally insane, again, without any sort of required hearings. Now, keep in mind that this happened 3 years later, when you still had the left being really interested in prison issues, when you had all these various liberation movements working in solidarity with prisoner activists inside and ex-prisoners on the outside. And think about why it is that we somehow remember Attica and it's in the history books and we've collectively forgotten the August Rebellion. Like, what does that say about what we think about when we think about who's in prison, who resists in prison, and what prisoner activism looks like? The August Rebellion was not the first time or the only time that women have rioted. In 1835, the first separate prison for women was opened in the United States, and it was opened in Mount Pleasant, which is someplace in Westchester County. And it was the first prison for women, and the environment was so terrible that the women rioted right away. They attacked the prison matron, which is basically a female version of a prison warden. They tore her clothes off and drove her out of the prison. And then when other prison officials came to try to like restore order, they chased them off with wooden food tubs. So, you know, it's like, this is not the first time that women have like rebelled and rioted and said, these conditions are insane and we're not putting up with them. In 1954 in North Carolina, women rioted after a woman named Eleanor Rush, who was an 18-year-old black woman, was placed in solitary confinement for threatening a prison staff member. And she was placed in solitary confinement for 6 days. And this is 1954 in North Carolina. On the seventh day, the prison staff decided they weren't going to feed her. So after 16 hours of not getting any food, Eleanor Rush started yelling through the bars of her cell that she was hungry and she wanted to be fed. And instead of feeding her, the prison staff came and they bound her and they gagged her. And in the process of gagging her, they dislocated her neck. Half an hour later, Eleanor Rush was dead. The next morning, when women in that prison gathered in the yard to like, the women who were not placed in solitary confinement gathered in the yard to like hang out, enjoy the sunshine, talk to each other, play baseball, walk around. Another woman who had been in the solitary confinement unit yelled down to them through her window that Eleanor Rush was dead, that the guards had somehow killed her, you know, and, you know, like they were taking her body away. And the women surrounded the staff members who were supervising them in the yard, and they said, we want to know what happened to Eleanor Rush. How did she die? How did she die? What happened? How do we know this isn't going to happen to us? And keep in mind that this is 1954 in North Carolina. Why was the body of a young black woman taken to the White Hospital for an autopsy? What are you trying to cover up? And when the prison staff wouldn't answer the question, they stuttered and they stumbled and they like had non-answers, the women rioted. And they rioted for 3.5 hours. And again, keep in mind, this is 1954 in North Carolina, black women and white women all rioted. You know, so the white women didn't say this isn't our problem, you know, whatever, you know, this was not somebody, one of us. Women of all races, or black and white races, who was in North Carolina prisons at the time, rioted. And they said, enough is enough. And in response, the prison called in the Raleigh police and guards from the neighboring male prison to take back the prison. However, as a result of this riot, the State Bureau of Investigation ordered a probe into Eleanor Rush's death instead of accepting the prison's explanation that she had somehow dislocated her own neck and therefore it was her fault. They said, no, we're actually going to have an investigation into her death. The state prisons director realized that there was nothing in the prison rules that explicitly said you cannot gag a prisoner, and the rules were changed to explicitly ban gagging of prisoners, and also they banned a use of another restraining device called the iron claw, which was a metal handcuff that you could use to really squeeze somebody's wrist tightly to restrain them. And so as a result of the fact that the women rioted, the prison was forced to change some of their policies. The prison was also required to pay $3,000 to Eleanor Rush's mother. And when you think about the fact that $3,000 is never going to bring back her daughter, you have to keep in mind that one of the ways that government bodies can be held accountable is to make them pay for what they did, because you hit them where it hurts, which is their pocketbook. And in 1954, $3,000 was more than half the yearly salary of the prison warden. So it was a huge amount of money for them to have to pay for having killed this woman in prison. And the prison superintendent was replaced by a woman with a more social work, social services background. So it was a shift from this really punitive way of dealing with women in prison to like a more social work, social services oriented approach. So all this happened because the women rioted. And when they were called to testify before the State Bureau of Investigation, both the black women and the white women all said, we rioted because we knew otherwise the prison would just sweep this woman's death under the rug. They would just say she did it to herself, and nothing would happen to them, and things would go on as normal, and women would continue to be mistreated and die. And so we rioted specifically to get people's attention and to get outside attention and scrutiny, you know, into this prison. So these are some ways in which women have rebelled and rioted and, you know, rose up. And somehow, again, like, collectively, we're not remembering any of this. So, like, keep in mind that if we're not remembering any of these things, we're not looking at ways that women have resisted in less dramatic ways. So now I kind of wanted to open it up and ask people what they think about when they think about women in prison. Like, what issues, you know, come to mind?
Mothers.
Yes. The majority of women in prison, or the majority of people in prison, are... If anybody's a Sharpie or a marker, that would
be appreciated.
Ah, yes.
I have a Sharpie, if that doesn't work.
Okay.
Probably, I don't know if it's good or not.
Can everybody do this?
Yeah.
So the majority of people in prison are parents. However, when you have, you can see how gender plays out in incarceration, the way it does in society. So that when a father goes to prison, oftentimes there's a female relative, his mother, his wife, his girlfriend, his, you know, ex-girlfriend, his sister. Somebody will step up, and usually it's a female relative, to take care of his children while he's incarcerated. When a mother goes to prison, oftentimes she's already a single head of household. Or if she has a partner, that partner is arrested alongside of her, and, you know, like in the case, or this partner says, I can't take care of the children, and splits. You know, so children of incarcerated mothers are 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than children of incarcerated fathers. And this is particularly pernicious because in 1997, Congress passed the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, which stated that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, that child, the state automatically has to start termination of parental rights, which means the state starts paperwork to legally sever forever the rights of that parent to that child. And it doesn't matter if that parent is going to get out 2 months later, you know, if they have a job and a, you know, an apartment and everything else lined up, those rights are terminated.
Did you say that was a federal law?
Federal law. And 15 months was based on a political compromise between the two houses of Congress. One house wanted 12 months, one house wanted 18 months, and then they came up with 15 months as their compromise. So none of this is based in, like, child development psychology or when is, you know. So even though this is touted as being for the best interest of the child, really it's just, like, a lot of political maneuvering. And again, when you think about the way that society genders parenting, you know, you can see how this impacts incarcerated mothers far more than it's impacted incarcerated fathers. Other issues that people think about?
Drug policy.
Yes. The number of women in prison since the 1970s has skyrocketed, and a lot of it has to do with mandatory sentencing and the mandatory drug laws. In 1973, our lovely Governor Rockefeller, the same one that ordered the shooting into the Attica prison yard, passed the Rockefeller drug laws that stated if you have 4 ounces of a narcotic for personal use or 2 ounces of a narcotic for, you know, for supposedly for sale, you could face a mandatory sentence of 15 years to life. And it didn't matter if it was your first offense, you know, if it was a nonviolent crime, whatever, you know, this is what you were looking at. And there was no discretion to say, you know what, this is your first time offense, maybe you need to go to rehab, maybe you need to go to parole, maybe, you know, like, you are automatically looking at a prison sentence. And the number of women in prison skyrocketed. And other states have all followed suit, so every state now has some form of mandatory sentencing. And in 1986, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, and part of that act stated that police and prosecutors could charge spouses and lovers with conspiracy for things like answering the phone and taking a phone message, or signing for a package, or things that you do when you live with somebody. You know, you take messages, you sign for packages, you pick up the mail, and they could charge them with conspiracy, and oftentimes because spouses and lovers didn't have any other information to give other than John called at 2 and his package came the next morning at 11, and, you know, they weren't able to plea bargain for something, for a lesser charge. So while there haven't actually been any studies done as to how many women have been incarcerated in federal prison because of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, from the women I talked to who have served time in federal prison, they've said a lot of women are in prison because of something that their, you know, spouse or lover did, but because of this Anti-Drug Abuse Act, they got swept up in that as well, and they were sentenced to long periods in prison. Other?
Female or gynecological health?
Yes. Female health care and health care in general. healthcare in prison is abysmal. So when I talk about how awful things are in women's prisons, I don't want anybody to think that like men are living the high life and, you know, getting like lots of good stuff in prisons. It's just that if men are getting nothing, women are getting less than nothing. So like if you look at it that way, it makes more sense than like, oh look, they're, you know. But prisons have always been set up with like the heterosexual male in mind, and this hasn't changed in the like 300 something years that we've had prisons. And this also applies to things like healthcare. So most prisons don't have gynecologists or an easy way to provide gynecological services. Oftentimes they don't want to be bothered. They don't have the resources to deal with women who enter pregnant, and 4 to 5% of women who enter prisons every year enter when they're pregnant. And so they have to like sort of like figure out a way to like, you know, bring them to an outside hospital. But then that means that the prison doctor often is like somebody who has no experience dealing with pregnant women or gynecological problems. So if there's an emergency, that's who you go to, is like a foot doctor. There's also no screenings for breast cancer or cervical cancer. There's no immediate treatment for things like if a woman finds a lump on her breast or has some other like female-related problem. So again, it's like if you look at the fact that prison healthcare is abysmal, you have to look at the fact that there's like even less resources to deal with the fact that, you know, women are coming into prison with also like a very specific set of health problems that, you know, aren't being addressed. In addition, women who go to prison are more likely to enter with HIV than either men going into prison or women on the outside. And this is partially because if you look at who goes to prison, it's usually people on like the lowest rung of the economic ladder. So it's people who don't have a lot of resources or opportunities to survive in other ways. And so women who end up going to prison are often people who had no other ways to survive and thrive than to do things that involve their bodies, you know, which makes them more susceptible to contracting HIV, AIDS, and other STDs. So they're more likely to have HIV than the male that goes to prison, who oftentimes didn't have to use his body in the same way to survive and thrive, or say like a middle-class housewife or career woman who obviously had a lot more opportunities to like be able to make money and get by in society. Other issues that come to mind when you think of women in prison?
Sexual assault.
Yes. Sexual assault is prevalent in women's prisons, and the majority of it in both men's and women's prisons is actually perpetrated by prison staff onto people, you know, prisoners, not, you know, prisoner on prisoner, although I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the majority of it actually is prison staff members. In 1964, under one of the civil rights legislation, there was the Equal Employment Act, which stated that people could be employed in prisons regardless of gender. So if you were a woman, you could work in a male prison. And that also meant that if you were a man, you could work in a woman's prison. And this was passed with no consideration as to like how the power dynamics would play out if you had men guarding women in prison, and you didn't make any specifications as to where in the women's prison they could be. So men could be in like areas where women would be in states of undress, like the shower area, the toilet area, and state by state, women have challenged this, but it's only because women have challenged the male guards are not allowed in certain areas of the prison. But otherwise, it means that like male guards can watch a woman shower and say, "Well, I'm doing my job because somebody needs to watch you while you're in the shower. You know, I can watch you when you're undressing because I need to make sure you're not going to run away or whatever." You know, but it could all be considered as like part of their job. And when you've got people with that much power and the keys to, you know, the prison cell and like the ability to regulate somebody's life, you've got, you know, a much more likely possibility and probability that sexual assault and sexual abuse will happen. Other things that come to mind? Think of. Yes?
Trans women?
Yes. In the U.S., people aren't necessarily like placed in the prisons of like what their gender identification is. They rely on like what your birth certificate is, and often what like your genitalia is. So you've got like a huge issue of trans women being placed in men's prisons. And I'm sure there's also you know, like a lot of trans men, although I haven't heard as much about it, being placed in women's prisons. And that's like a huge issue in terms of like the potential for like sexual assault, sexual abuse, you know, the ability to kind of erase what somebody's, you know, identity is, you know, and a whole host of other problems.
Child, like shackling during childbirth?
Yes. New York State actually, in August, I think, or September, just outlawed. It's like the sixth or seventh state to have outlawed shackling during childbirth, which means that there's 40-something other states that still allow for shackling during childbirth. But until August or September of last year, in New York State, as in many other states, women who were escorted out, even when they were pregnant and they were going into labor and about to have a baby, would be shackled, which meant that they were handcuffed like this, and then there was a chain that led to their belly, and then their feet were shackled. So basically, you're kind of walking around like that. If you've ever seen like an old like movie about chain gangs, you know, it's kind of like that. Now, when you have a baby, I don't know how many people in this room had a baby, witnessed having a baby, you kind of need to be able to move. So this, you know, hugely compromises like the woman's health, the, you know, the coming baby's health. It just doesn't make medical sense. And again, it was only recently that New York State finally like passed an anti-shackling, you know, law, and several other states have anti-shackling laws, but most states still are like, it's up to the prison personnel as to whether or not you get shackled when she's going into labor, and it is up to the prison staff member who accompanies the woman as to when the shackles come off. It's not actually up to the medical personnel to be like, the shackles need to come off. They need to actually argue with, you know, the prison staff member that accompanies the woman.
How commonplace is
that? In New York State, women have like talked about being shackled during childbirth. One of the pushes during like the like move to have this anti-shackling go past in New York State was by women who have been incarcerated in New York State. And a couple of them actually told their stories of having to give birth, you know, like being escorted to the hospital in shackles, like having to like give birth, you know, while shackled and like having the shackles removed last minute. So I don't actually know like how common it is. I know there's a couple of women that I've worked with that were not shackled when they were in labor. So it might be the discretion of, you know, the prison personnel. It might be policy of the various prisons. I'm not sure how they figure out like, who gets shackled and who doesn't. Except when there's a law that says you can't shackle a woman in prison. You had your hands up?
Yeah. I'd like to know the number of the women in prison and what's happened to the political female?
The political?
Yeah.
Like political prisoners or?
Female.
Yes. There are women political prisoners?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, but...
About,
there are women political prisoners? Yeah, obviously.
What's happened?
Like what's
the question from the all females or the...
It depends on the situation. Like, I'm not necessarily focusing on women political prisoners.
No?
So, okay. No. It's because, like, I'm focusing more on, like, sort of, like, gender, incarceration, and resistance. Mm-hmm. Women political prisoners have been separated. In the 1980s, there was actually this, what was it called, high security unit in Lexington, Kentucky. It was an experimental unit. It was painted all white. They put 3 or 5 women political prisoners in there. It was specifically for them. It was designed to like basically drive them insane. Because everything was painted white. They didn't have any human contact. Like, the guards would like talk to them through these loudspeakers that came out over the thing. Yeah, so like, so sometimes they're separated, sometimes they're separated, you know, in these, like, crazy ways where they started hallucinating things because they were in this, like, all-white room all the time, you know, and they were, like, you know, like, and it was designed to break them.
What experiment?
Huh?
You said they did an experiment. What experiment?
It was the Lexington, the high security unit in Lexington, Kentucky. And basically, like, the advocacy of outside people, you know, and people doing work around political prisoners finally got it shut down, and the women were sent back to the federal prisons they were in. Women political prisoners have been, like, in general population. One of the women who, like, I didn't ask, you know, political prisoners what their experiences with organizing were, because what I kind of wanted to do was talk to women who were not political before they went in to see how they were resisting, rather than having political prisoners who were organizing on the outside and obviously are going to go into prison and continue organizing, like talk about their experiences organizing. But afterwards, in talking to some former political prisoners, they talked about the fact that when they were placed with the other women really supported them. Like, I actually did a talk a few days ago where a woman actually said that she'd been in prison with Asada Shakur, in New Jersey, and the guards would do things like they had her in a solitary confinement cell, and the guards would mix up her food. So basically, like, her food tray would come, and there'd be like all whatever crappy food you get, and they would basically take it all. Like, you mix the milk with the bread and the peas and the whatever thing to pass as meat there, and you mix it all up so it's inedible. And they'd be like, "Huh, here's your food." And the women saw that, and they were like, "No," you know. So they would actually, when they were walking by her cell, they would like slip her something, you know. They'd be like, "Here's, you know, like part of my sandwich. Here's, you know," to keep her, you know, to make sure that like she didn't break from like lack of like being able to get any food. So like, people who are in for political, who are political prisoners, sometimes get treated more harshly. Sometimes they're not. You know, like there's not a universal sort of blanket statement. And I think there actually is a workshop about political prisoners later that, you know, probably answers some more of your questions about that. Other issues that people think about? Yes.
I guess this is just related to some personal experiences, but with women trying to get clean and sober in prison, I've brought meetings like recovery meetings into women's prisons for a couple of years, and it's incredibly difficult. Like the guards don't even want to let us in; they treat us like there's something wrong with us because we're on the side of the prisoners trying to do something productive, and it's just like how that affects people not being able to have access. Like, maybe, you know, it could be, like, there's volunteers willing to do this multiple times a week, and we're lucky if we get to go in once or twice a month.
Mm-hmm. There's a huge resistance in all prisons, I want to say, like, to, like, people coming in and doing programs with people in prison, unless you're a fundamentalist Baptist, you know? Like then you kind of, like, get this, like, pass that's like, ooh, look, you can go in and, like, have fundamentalist Baptist programs. But for the most part, it seems that, like, you know, like, prisons are really resistant to, like, this idea of rehabilitation or people being able to change themselves, you know, for the better. So I don't want to say that that's, like, particular to women in prison, but there are actually have been studies that show that women's prisons get less programming, you know, like, than men's prisons as well. So it's, like, because there's more support, like, there are more men in prison, and because there are more men in prison, people tend to universalize, like, prison experiences. Heterosexual male prisoner, you know, like, it's not, you know, and so programs are kind of designed with that in mind, and so programs that don't kind of fit that Baptist or cookie cutter, like, universal male experience mode, you know, tend to be, like, looked at kind of askance, and they have a harder time getting in. And also there are groups on the outside that kind of don't see, you know, what women's experiences are and need to, like, tailor to them. Like, I've read studies that show that women's reasons for using drugs often are linked to, like, abuse and trauma versus, like, men's experiences, like, using drugs, which usually are not. But there actually are, like, you know, less educational and vocational programs, and I guess also, like, rehabilitative, I don't know what you would call, like, drug, you know, drug treatment or drug counseling programs in women's prisons than there are in men's prisons.
Yes. Do you know, is there, like, law that surrounds that, or is it just individual prison policy that
Individual prison policy. Like, I mentioned Bedford Hills Correctional Facility earlier. It's in Westchester County, you know, so it's, like, in this, like, rich neighborhood, you know, and there are, for a women's prison, it's got, like, a shit, I can count curse now, right? It's got a shitload of programs, you know, like, in comparison to, like, you know, a lot of other women's prisons. Across the street is Taconic Correctional Facility. Same wealthy neighborhood, you know, like, same, you know, like, people around it, and it's got almost nothing. You know, only recently did it have, like, a college education program. Before that, there was, like, a drug treatment program, and that was it. You know, like, so if you wanted to, like, learn anything else, you, too bad, so sad. But I think it actually is, like, so it's individual prison policy. Like, it depends on the administration. The administration in Bedford Hills was considered more liberal, you know, like, and they were, you know, for you know, there are many flaws of being a prison administration. They were more willing to let outside folks in with a lot of restrictions, mind you. I don't want to be like, oh, they were perfect, you know, but they were more willing to let outside programs in than the administration at the time, you know, that was like, no, we don't have to, so we're not going to. like having outside people come in is a hassle. Yes?
It came in a little bit late, so I'm not sure, but I assume female healthcare applies to like OBGYN types of things.
Yes.
But I'm curious about how chronic disease treatment works, like around HIV or hepatitis C or things like that. Like, if people have access to treatment, women have access to treatment, but, or, you know what I mean?
It, again, is like a prison by prison thing. You know, like, so there's not like one blanket policy that's like, everybody must have healthcare, you know. In some states, they actually have this awful thing now where they like privatize their healthcare system. So basically, like the prison contracts with a private corporation that provides medical services. And this private corporation, basically, their main goal is to make as much money as possible. So if you get paid, and I'm going to just pull a number out of my ass, I don't actually know what they get paid. Let's just say you get like paid like, you know, like $70 per prisoner, you know, that you provide medical services for, and provide being in quotation marks, you know, you basically try to spend as little money as possible treating that person. So for chronic conditions like HIV, AIDS, hepatitis C, things that need actual care, like they actually have something called, I forget what the term is, but basically it's like a paperwork protocol where you keep submitting paperwork and you keep submitting paperwork and you actually never get that treatment because, oh wait, you submitted paperwork C but you forgot paperwork B and a half, and you know, like after you submit B and a half you go to D, but then wait, you gotta go back to A because A expired, and you know, so there's like, it's like, I don't know, like that three card Monty game or something where you're constantly trying to like keep on top of it and you just never actually get, you know, the healthcare that you need. And then in prisons that have prison-run healthcare, it's still sort of dicey as to whether or not you're going to get healthcare, especially in the time that you need in order to like survive. Mm-hmm.
Mental health and mental illness.
Yes. Mental health issues are huge in prison, especially because, you know, our states in all their like wisdom close mental health programming a lot. Like, you know, so like, people who have mental health issues that maybe would be seeking treatment in mental health facilities, like now don't have facilities to seek mental health treatment for, and so they're locked up, you know, in prisons instead of, you know, mental health, or getting treatment. Like, I'm not saying that people should be locked up in mental health facilities, but like, there's not a way for them to get treatment and maybe be able to like survive in society without like either resorting to some criminal act or seeming like they shouldn't be in society and thus getting locked up. And then once they're inside, then they are punished even more from having mental health issues, because if you can't follow orders, or, you know, like you have an illness that requires something and you're not getting that, you know, treatment for it, they're going to be like, you're disobedient, you're disruptive, you're this, that, and the other. You go into solitary confinement. You are not allowed to do what little things you can do. Like, you can't go out in the yard. You can't, you know, you can't socialize with other people, et cetera, et cetera. So it's sort of like that downward spiral.
I'm from New Hampshire, so I just recently visited New Hampshire State Prison for Men, and in the unit for the psychiatric inmates, they had a small, kind of, not solitary, but very closed off for about 10 women, because the women's prison in New Hampshire doesn't have adequate mental health counseling. So instead of, they either get put in the hospital, like the New Hampshire State Hospital for psychiatric patients, or they get sent to the men's prison, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw maybe one female guard for all of those people, mm-hmm. all the 10 women, and that was awful.
So there's also, like, you can see, like, there's like a lack of programming, you know, like in, or like, you know, like lack of services, and I kind of hate to say it, but it's also sort of like, well, at least they're putting the women, like, getting them treatment someplace, but it's still awful.
Absolutely.
It's like, well. And also, that brings up the question, why is it that you have to go to prison to get any of these services?
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell don't we have these services on the outside? You know, like, we're cutting mental health services on the outside, drug treatment programs on the outside, so basically you get locked up, and then maybe you have a chance of getting these services on the inside, as opposed to being like, let's talk about, you know, addressing the reasons why people go to prison. You know, if drug addiction, or, you know, like, if drug problems are one of them, like, let's address that on the outside. Let's not send people into prison, you know, to, like, then maybe address it 10 years down the line. Other things that come to mind when you think about women in prison? Yes?
I came here late, so I'm sorry, but I have two things to say. I guess this isn't a question, but I was in one of those facilities, a mental health lockdown facility, after being arrested and going to Rikers Island, brought to Elmhurst Hospital. And it was a lockdown ward, and there's absolutely no focus on healing or rehabilitation. It is just women mulling around, oftentimes getting so bored that they become more violent, whereas that might not happen if there was a healing aspect. Groups that you might go to, there's just a television on and, you know, stuff like that. It's very miserable, no focus on healing. The question that I was going to ask, I recently missed a forum on California prisons, women's prisons, and eugenics, and was curious how much people have to share about their knowledge about that. There are a lot of women being sterilized, apparently, in California prisons, and it's now become legal. And the women are often sterilized without their consent. So I think that would be interesting to talk about.
I actually hadn't heard that, but that's actually a really horrifying point. And it kind of like goes back to like also one of the things that like, you know, when you think about people who go to prison, you know, like you look at like sort of like the race dynamics of most of prison, and it's mostly like poor people and people of color. And these are often the first people, like when they have eugenics programs, they get sterilized. Because it's like, oh no, we can't let poor people reproduce because they're not fit parents, you know, like, we can't let people of color reproduce, you know, like, once slavery was over and you can't make money off of, you know, black and brown children, it's like, oh, you know, like, black people were often, like, you know, like, sterilized without their consent or their knowledge. So that's horrifying to hear that, like, this practice is actually not just coming back into vogue, but it's actually being legalized as, you know, something that is wanted. Like, also when you lock women up, like, the majority of women in prison are locked up, like, you know, like, and basically kind of miss the childbearing years. So that's another form of eugenics that is, like, unofficial. Like, when you get somebody who is in their, like, 20s and you lock them up for a long period of time, by the time they get out, they're in their, like, 40s, 50s, 60s, and childbearing age is over. And that is another form of, like, you know, of eugenics, is to just make sure that there's no way for them to be able to reproduce while they're, you know, during that time period. And you don't even have to have a law. But it is horrifying that now you can legally just go ahead and, like, surgically sterilize them.
What happens to the children of women who do give birth in prison? I'm guessing they just get thrown right into the
social services.
Social services or adoption.
In most states, women have 24 to 48 hours to, like, basically, like, have a relative come pick them up. You know, pick the child up, not pick the woman up. If there is no relative willing to, like, take on this task, then the child goes to social services and foster care, and that clock starts ticking the 15 of the 22 months the child's in foster care. In a couple of states, there are prison nurseries, so Bedford Hills has one. Actually, I think Taconic has one, where women who fit certain criteria, i.e. you cannot be a hellraiser, you cannot have filed a lot of complaints against the administration, you cannot, like, basically you toe the line and you say yes to everything and you don't rock the boat, can apply to be in the prison nursery program, where they can spend, depending on the prison, like 18 to 24 months with their children. And these are, like, nicer, like, sort of nicer facilities, you know, like, then, like, they're in the prison, but they're, like, in nicer wards, you know, like, they're, it's not, like, disgusting. But actually, there's, in Latin America, women, you know, are often allowed to keep their children with them as well. And there's actually a really interesting movement in Argentina of women in prison saying, you know what, we don't want to have our children in prison with us, but we don't want to be separated. We want to, like, actually, like, have, you know, like, better, like, human living conditions for us. And they rioted from, like, 2003 to, like, 2009, like, series of riots where they were, like, we need a pediatrician, like, a 24-hour pediatrician, because if you're going to have children here, you're going to, you know, we need, you know, like, we need to have an on-call doctor because the children get sick. You know, we need there to be better food. We need there to be this, that, and the other. And basically they forced lawmakers into, you know, through this series of riots to pass a law that stated that women with children under the age of 5 and women who are pregnant got first priority for house arrest.
you know, so like they would serve their, you know, their sentences up until their child was 5 at home with their kids, like with a freaking ankle monitor, rather than being, having to choose whether or not they're going to raise their children in a prison and kind of like institutionalize them with them, or have to be separated with their kids. So it's like this form of like decarceration that, like, you know, that says we understand the importance of the mother-child bond, and we also, you know that prison is not really a place that we want to be raising our children. And also women who were not mothers also participated in these riots. So it wasn't just the mothers rioting, it was like every woman in the prison, and sometimes their visitors who were in the visiting room would be like, okay, we're gonna riot because this is insane. You know, like, we don't want to be raising our children, you know, like, in these conditions. But in the U.S., we've got the nursery system in a couple of states, and foster, you know, like, having your child whisked away in other states. In California, there was a mother-baby alternative to incarceration program for women who are entering pregnant or with small children. And I think only 2 years ago, they finally got rid of the rule that you had to have perfect teeth to, like, be able, like, basically, you had to have no dental problems. And when you look again at people who go into prison, they're at the bottom of the economic ladder. They're often not getting proper health care, let alone dental care. So, you know, they would basically like be like, okay, well, in order to qualify for being able to spend time with my, like, child in this alternative to incarceration, I need to, like, somehow get rid of all these cavities and everything else. So women were opting to, like, have their teeth pulled. You know, so basically, like, yeah, it's like, okay, you don't have, like, health care, you don't have dental care. And faced with this possibility, if you've got this small, like, 1.5 to 2 year window with your small child, you know, they can only be, you know, taken if you have, like, good dental hygiene versus, you know, like, not. Women were like, yeah, just pull my teeth. And then suddenly you had, like, all these women who were like, I don't have, you know, teeth. And again, it's a way that we kind of, like, have gender. It's a way in which, like, we, like, see gender impacting incarceration, because this was not happening among men in prison, you know. Other?
Just speaking of that, why, like, what is the rationale behind that? Like, what, having perfect dental teeth?
I don't know, they didn't want to pay for dental care if, like, the woman went in and, like, had, you know, went into this program and had a cavity. I'm not sure what the rationale is, you know, for, like, being, like, you know, like, you have to have, like, perfect dental, you know, dental health. You know, so maybe they didn't want to deal with, maybe their rationale is, like, you know, like, that they didn't want to deal with, like, having to pay for somebody's dental care. You know, if she came in and someone was like, I have an abscess and this needs to be taken care of. But, you know, really, I think it's, like, another way of, like, controlling, you know, who goes into the program. You can kind of use whatever rationale you want.
I don't know if that's specific to women's prisons, because I know that in California, specifically in a lot of different counties, the dental care in prisons pretty awesome for the men's, but, like, I know quite a few men in prison that have said, well, I would never have been able to get this care on the outside, and I got all my teeth taken care of. So I don't know if that's specific to that place or to women's, or maybe if they, like you said, they're just trying to control women who are in this position where they want to spend time with their children.
I think it's you know, like, again, like, you know, like, women's health care is, like, substandard to men's health care, and men's health care often isn't good, you know, like, you know, so I'm kind of, like, amazed that you're like, oh, yeah, some of my friends, you know, have had good dental care.
My friend just wrote me a letter about it last week. That's why he's like, I got all my teeth, because he has, like, major teeth problems for years, and he said he just got them all taken care of because he's been San Quentin, actually.
So, you know, so when you look at, like, substandard, you know, like, health care for women in prison, and, like, substandard programming and everything else, and also, like, you know, like, the fact that, you know, people who go into prison often don't have that kind of dental hygiene. I'm just not surprised. But yeah. I've heard horror stories from women being like, I had an abscess, and, like, I could have died, and, like, it took, you know, like, months and months and months, you know, for me to be able to get, like, proper medical treatment. So, like, I'm, you know. So I don't actually know what, like, the sort of statistics would be for, like, you know, the rationale between, like, who gets better dental care than others in prisons. Anything else? Yes?
I'm assuming it's probably pretty similar to men's prisons, which is more of a like, abstinence-based policy for drug use. But I'm also, like, familiar with harm reduction programs in general outside of prisons that are very male-focused. So I'm curious how that works in a women's prison, like, what the idea is.
There is no harm reduction idea in women's prisons. One of the things I'm going to talk about in a minute is the AIDS Counseling and Education Program at Bedford Hills, where they basically like understood that women had to kind of take control about like educating their peers about, you know, HIV and AIDS. And one of the things that got them shut down for a while was somebody from an outside hospital came and talked about harm reduction, and the administration flipped out and was like, no. You know, like we do not acknowledge that drugs happen in prison, we do not acknowledge that sex happens in prison, no. You know, kind of thing. So there's not. Like, in prisons, it's like, sex, no. Drugs, no. You know, like, not like, sort of like, we understand that people are going to continue using this and guards are going to continue smoking drugs in. Yes?
Have you some history with the possibility to run away, to escape?
To escape?
Yeah.
I don't know. I
don't have history?
Huh?
You don't have a history in
the
U.S. prison here to escape?
No
possibilities?
I don't know if there's no possibilities, but that's not something that I sort of like, you know, study.
What the number? You have the number?
Of escapes? No.
Not escape in the prison.
Of how many prisons there are?
Yeah.
No.
Today?
No, that I do not. They're always building new ones and converting them, but yeah, no, I don't have numbers. If you go to the U.S. Department of Justice website, you might be able to find something as to like how many there are.
Yeah?
Maybe.
I came in late, so sorry if you've already covered this, but I was wondering about sentencing disparities.
Yes.
A friend of mine works at Rutgers as a social worker, and she told me this story that she said was actually fairly common. She deals with women who are being held for accused of having killed their children, and this woman had an abusive husband. He actually killed the child. But she got twice the sentence that he got for because of neglect or something like that. And I was wondering if you want to study how common that is.
There are huge sentencing disparities, both in terms of race, you know, and drugs, and also like sort of like. And I don't know how to like frame it because I don't think it's in any like it's not like codified into the law. It's like we will sentence women who are going to go in. But there's this idea that women are sort of more in need of reform or fixing. So women often get all the time fixing. Like they're when they have to be imprisoning women in larger numbers, women would get more time than their male co-defendants, you know, for the same crime. Women were also the first, I don't know if everybody's heard of this term indeterminate sentencing, where basically it's like an open sentence. It's like, you know, George Jackson had it, like 1 year to life. And depending on whether or not you were deemed, redeemable or reformed by the parole board, that was when you would get out. But basically, it was like this open-ended sentence. You could spend the rest of your life in prison. And it was first used for women. They were like, we have this idea that women who commit crimes have violated this gender norm, that they're supposed to be these perfect middle-class angels, and therefore they need to be fixed. And we don't know how long it'll take to fix them. So we're going to sentence them to basically like a long period of time, and when they can show that they can, like, you know, like, adhere to proper gender norms, whatever those norms were, like, in the 1800s, it was, like, don't get drunk, don't have sex, don't, you know, don't talk back to your parents, don't have a job, don't be independent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, then we'll let them out. So, like, I think it's kind of a throwback to that. There's also been studies that have been done that show that men who kill their female partners get less time than women that kill their male partners. And again, I don't think there's anything, I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer, I don't think there's anything codified into law that says, like, you know, you will be sentenced to this much, you know, based on your gender or based on the gender of the person you killed.
Yeah.
But, like, again and again, we can see that.
Do you know if there's anything in the law about whether women have a greater legal responsibility for a child than...
That I don't know.
Because I found that case really, I mean, they were essentially...
It might also be
based
a,
on some idea
of responsibility. It might be a societal bias, too, where we're, like, parenting people... Women, you know, parenting equals mothers. Obviously, the mother's responsible for this.
Yes, just in response, I don't think it's in the law in terms of women are more responsible for the parent because you can't be, you know, you have to have equal protection in the law and people can't, you can't discriminate in the way the laws are written. But absolutely, in my experience as a social worker working in people and family courts and stuff, that is absolutely the way it's applied. Like, even in terms of outside of incarceration, but in terms of when ACS becomes involved in a child. Life and they will set different standards on a mother to regain custody than a father because mothers have to prove more. They were a bad mother, it's like worse. And if a father just shows up in court, like I've seen judges just like just because he showed up, it's like amazing and he needs to be congratulated on that. Like, and so absolutely that's the way it's applied, but it's not written that way.
One last thing that I want to bring up, and then I kind of wanted to shift it to like resistance, so like it's not just sort of like bad, awful things are happening in prison, and everybody goes away wanting to like kill themselves, is that women in prison are more likely to have suffered physical, emotional, and or sexual abuse than men in prison, or women that don't go to prison. So more than half of women in state prisons and jails have self-reported having experienced physical and or sexual abuse prior to their arrest and incarceration. And when you look at the ways that like people self-report, you know, abuse, especially to like some researcher with a clipboard, you can assume that these numbers are much, much higher because most people aren't going to self-report abuse to like some stranger that comes around with a clipboard. Women are 3 times more likely than men in prison to have been physically and or sexually abused as children. So basically you're looking at a population that has experienced a lot of like trauma and violence in their lives. And actually, in New York State, approximately 82% of women in prison have been physically or sexually abused as children, and 75% have suffered physical violence by a partner as an adult. So, like, again, it's sort of like, so you have a population that, by and large, has, like, suffered a lot of violence and trauma, and prisons really aren't set up to deal with that, nor do they kind of care about that. You know, so that's something else to keep in mind when, you know, like, you're looking at, like, women in prison and women's prison issues. Now I want to like move on to sort of like ways in which women have resisted and organized. So again, it's sort of like we're not just sort of like all these awful things are happening inside women's prisons and like we can't do anything about it. So I said that I was going to start by talking about the AIDS Counseling and Education Program at Bedford Hills. In 1987, women imprisoned at the Bedford Hills Maximum Security Prison for Women wanted to start changing conditions around HIV and AIDS, both like, you know, like the way the medical treatment was conducted and also the way that people were perceiving HIV and AIDS. Like at the time in the late 80s, there's still a lot of ignorance and stigma around HIV and AIDS, and this was exacerbated by the fact that when you're in a prison, you're kind of cut off from like any new news or developments in society. So women would refuse to share meals with women, like have them on their housing units, sit next to them, do their laundry with them. And when you think about like prisons, especially maximum security prisons where you're serving 15, 20, 25 years life. In these prisons, it's kind of like being in like your junior high school cafeteria for the rest of your life. Like you can't get up and find yourself like another place to go sit, you know, like it's like you are just there forever. So women were really afraid to come out about their status, and when you come out about your, or when you don't come out about your health status, you're less likely to seek treatment because you're going to be red flagged as, you know, being HIV positive or having AIDS or having some sort of health problem that women are afraid to catch. And also in one case, women petitioned the prison administration to get a woman off their housing unit because they thought she had HIV. And they were worried that if she lived on their housing unit, they would somehow catch it, you know, by her living there. So this is what was happening in 1987, you know, in the late 80s at Bedford Hills. And in prisons across the country, you know, you can kind of like multiply that by like a bazillion. So several women who were incarcerated at Bedford Hills, including a couple of women political prisoners who were there, decided that they wanted to take some steps to change this. They realized that changing women's attitudes and actions wasn't going to come from like some guy from the Department of Health giving a once-a-month lecture with slides, but actually from doing peer education, like going and like, you know, talking with women about like what HIV and AIDS was, how you could get it, how you couldn't get it, to like sort of dispel stereotypes. And, you know, like, and also making sure that women felt kind of comfortable going to medical examinations. So they did peer education, they did educational seminars for women in their housing units, on their floors, in the prisons. They used role-playing to break through barriers and to generate discussion. So, like, people would start to understand what the other person was feeling, how stigma and ignorance would affect them, and how their actions were affecting each other. And to, like, really examine the issues, like, underlying HIV and AIDS and, like, the fear around it. And they also began talking with women who were HIV positive, and they helped them formulate and articulate their questions that they would ask to their medical care providers. So, you know, like if they had specific questions they wanted to ask, like how do you get your medical care provider to like answer these questions? What do you need to know? If you can only see this doctor like once every 2 months, what do you need to know, you know, to make sure that you can get to the next appointment and still be healthy? And in some cases, they accompanied them to consultations if a woman didn't feel comfortable like bringing up all these issues and kind of challenging the prison doctor or the prison medical staff, who oftentimes were just kind of like, okay, we need to like shuffle you out the door. You know, it's like, we'll see you, you know, like see you in 2 months. And basically, like, this has done such a turnaround that, like, 12 years later, one woman, when asked about the peer education program and, like, the way that HIV and AIDS was perceived at Bedford Hills, said, if you hear stigma now, there are five people who immediately say, why did you have to say that? It's not okay anymore. And I know that is a direct result of ACE, the AIDS Counseling and Education Program, and our education process. And unless you think that this is just because it's, you know, the year 2000-something, you know, and attitudes about HIV and AIDS changed, I got a letter in 2007 from a woman in Oklahoma, which doesn't have the same type of peer education program about HIV and AIDS or communicable diseases, who said, the level of ignorance here is shocking. Women say stuff like, I don't want to wash my panties after her. What if her panties were bloody? People don't want to share cells or meals, so most women just keep their status a secret. So you can kind of see that, like, you know, like the way in which the 12 years in which women at Bedford Hills have, like, actively worked to organize and to educate other women around HIV and AIDS has turned around the idea that, like, you know, like, women with HIV and AIDS need to be, like, stigmatized and ostracized, to, like, looking at, like, another prison that didn't have this kind of process and didn't have women actively involved in working around these issues. And you can see the, like, level of ignorance there. And when you don't, you know, when you want to keep your status a secret, you're not ready for medical treatment, which means you're less likely to, like, survive your prison sentence or come out, you know, healthy. So again, I wanted to, like, point that out as a way in which women have organized that isn't necessarily something that we're going to, like, see as, like, prison organizing. You know, like, again, if we're not seeing these riots and rebellions that, like, are eye-catching and dramatic, we're not looking for resistance, you know, in lesser forms or, like, less visible forms. Going out of New York, in the late 1980s, women incarcerated at the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville, Ohio, formed a support group for women with long sentences. So this, on the face of this, this doesn't look like a necessarily, like, political group. It doesn't look like it's challenging anything about prison conditions or any of these things here. But many of them, in the course of talking to each other about, like, why they were there and what they were doing and how they were going to cope with their long sentences, realized that many of them had been sentenced to life for killing their abusers. Keep in mind, this is the late 1980s. People weren't talking about abuse and domestic violence. It wasn't framed as that. It was framed as, like, if you got hit, it was your fault. You know, like, if your partner hit you, you must have done something to provoke it. You know, like, there wasn't this idea that there was, like, abuse, there was battering, there were all these underlying, you know, problems with that. And so they began organizing around domestic violence, and they decided they were going to launch a clemency campaign. A clemency campaign is when you go to the governor and you say, like, I want a lessening of my sentence or I want freedom. Specifically for women imprisoned for self-defense, because they said, you know what? Why is it that, like, so many of us are in prison for killing, you know, our abusive spouses? And so they launched the first mass clemency campaign, you know, for women incarcerated for self-defense. And they not only launched this clemency campaign for themselves, but they also spoke with other women in prison, and they asked them, like, hey, what are you here for, you know? And they started helping them to understand that they had been abused, like, what abuse was, that they hadn't brought it on themselves, that like, you know, like, that they hadn't, you know, somehow brought this on themselves, that it was okay that they had acted in self-defense and finally just had enough. And they encouraged them to apply for clemency. And in some cases, they also helped them remember incidents of battering and, like, how they could find documentation to back up their request for clemency. And their efforts, like, basically going cell to cell, table to table, person to person, led to 18 additional women applying for clemency. So this is 18 additional women who might have sat in their prison cells for the rest of their lives thinking that somehow they had brought this on themselves. Like, they had killed their, like, loving husband or, you know, partner and were a bad person and shouldn't have done that and deserved to rot in jail. So that in itself is kind of amazing that there's, like, 18, there were 18 additional women, like, in 1990 that somehow were like, oh, you know, this was fucked up and I, you know, I had a right to defend myself. And in the end, 25 of those women were granted clemency. So basically, 25 women had their sentences lessened to the point where they could, like, be released. And this made headlines nationwide. It was the first mass clemency that worked. You know, the first mass clemency campaign, and then it worked. You know, for women incarcerated for self-defense. And there was, like, a big media storm about it. So some media were like, you know, like, oh, you know, these women were released. And some media were like, you know, husband killers walk, men beware, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it made headlines nationwide, and it influenced women incarcerated in California who had also started a support group for women who had been abused called Convicted Women Against Abuse, to do their own mass clemency campaign. Somebody read about this in the newspaper and brought it to the support group and said, you know what just happened in Ohio? All these women who were incarcerated for self-defense got clemency. I think we should do this too. And so they did their own mass clemency campaign, and they wrote a letter to then-Governor Pete Wilson saying, we want you to consider clemency, not just for us who have been incarcerated for self-defense, but for every single woman in the state of California who has killed, you know, who is incarcerated for killing for a reason. And they said, we would like to invite you to one of our weekly meetings so you can understand what abuse is and how we ended up here and what our stories are, so it's not like this vacuum. And, you know, like, and then we want you to consider this. And Governor Pete Wilson, being one of these law and order politicians that California loves so much, said, no, you know, I'm not going to come to your meeting. No, you know, I'm not going to consider clemency for every single woman incarcerated in the state of California for self-defense, but I will consider this as a request for clemency from you women who have signed it. And in the end, he granted clemency only to 3 women, he denied it to 7, and he made no decision on 24 of those women. So on the face of that, it kind of looks like, you know, it wasn't a spectacular success, but their letter and their actions drew the attention of outside lawyers and advocates who were like, wait a minute, you know, like, we had never really thought about the idea of women being imprisoned for self-defense before. And we want to support these women. You know, again, it's sort of like, what can we do to support people on the inside while having this end goal of, like, you know, like, chipping away this prison system and abolishing the prison system. And so they began, you know, helping the women draft their legal arguments, helping them find evidence, you know, to support their clemency petitions. And when Governor Wilson kind of didn't do very much with these petitions, they continued their efforts, and they formed a group called, that's still active in California, called Free Battered Women, that does educational seminars around abuse and incarceration and self-defense. They raise awareness, and they advocate for the release of women who are incarcerated for self-defense, whether it be like going before the parole board and really like rallying the parole board, because the parole board in California is notorious for not letting women out. They'll be like, you know, even though it was 25 years ago that you shot your husband, you know, and there's like huge amounts of evidence of abuse, we don't think you're rehabilitated yet. You know, so having outside advocates is huge, you know, to be like, you know, like, well, we're gonna like raise awareness about this. We're gonna like call the media in. We're gonna rally on your steps. We're gonna have people write letters in, you know, and then when and if the parole board like actually says, okay, we'll let you, the governor can reverse that decision, which governors in California seem prone to do, and so Free Battered Women will actually like then go to the governor's office and like flood him with phone calls and petitions and people rallying outside saying, you know what, this woman should never have been locked up in the first place, you need to let her out now, you know, like, you should not be reversing this decision. And since 2000, Free Battered Women's efforts have like helped with the release of 30 additional women incarcerated for self-defense. So while on the face of it, the convicted women against abuses like efforts seem to like be really small in comparison to the Ohio group, like their efforts actually caught the attention and kind of like launched this like movement to free women incarcerated for self-defense, you know, in the state of California. So that's like one way that I wanted to sort of point out as people being able to like work in solidarity with women on the inside as well. Again, with this idea that we improve conditions now, but in a way that like kind of like chips away at the prison system. Because we're kind of running out of time, and I don't want to like be those people that like, you know, like step on the next people's workshop, I'll be like, I'm gonna kind of like skip ahead. And if people want to talk to me afterwards about like other ways that women have organized,
I can for sure. The lunch break next.
No, there's like the parenting.
Others.
Yeah. I don't know if they give us lunch breaks. I think that they're just like, yeah. Just
sorry. I'm taking that.
So given that like I've just given you a few examples, you know, I wanted to like sort of leave with the question with like, what do you think are some ways that people on the outside can support women or people struggling on the inside, you know, without making the prison system bigger or stronger? And I wanted to give one like sort of cautionary tale first, you know, in terms of like ways in which the prison system and the government has co-opted language of reform to sort of like strengthen and bolster their prison system. So in California, which loves to lock people up, you know, even though they're broke, a couple of years ago, the California Department of Corrections released a report. They'd done a study of women incarcerated throughout the state, and they said, you know what, we have actually found that there are 4,500 women locked up in our state that don't actually need to be in prison. They are nonviolent, low-level, mostly drug and property offenders, and they would be better off in their communities, you know, know, getting drug treatment or job training or, you know, like, you know, counseling services, whatever they need, but they would be better off in the communities. So instead of devising a plan to start releasing these women into their communities and making sure they had social supports that they needed to, like, not end up in prison, they said, well, we're going to build these female corrective centers, or basically, in a sense, mini prisons. So they would be nicer prisons located closer to the urban centers where many of the women had come from. They would still be prisons. They wouldn't be allowed out. You know, they would still be under lock and key. And they would somehow be nicer and gentler and more gender responsive than, you know, the prisons that they were in currently. They were not going to close any of these prison beds that they vacated them from. So basically, it's like, we're going to build, you know, 4,500 new beds in these, like, nicer, gentler prisons, and still have these 4,500 other beds that we can fill with more women. And we're not going to be addressing any of the root causes of why women go to prison. We're not going to be addressing racism. We're not going to be, you know, addressing drug problems. We're not going to be, you know, addressing poverty or the feminization of poverty or any of these issues that, you know, like, have driven, like, so many women into prison. We're just going to, like, build these nicer prisons. And people in California rallied against this, and women on the inside in California also did. Like, they, like, you know, like, they wore armbands at certain times. They were like, okay, we're going to have this protest, you know, like, at such and such a date. Every woman just wore an armband. They said, like, no, we're against this. They signed this huge petition saying, like, basically, like, we're against this, even though 4,500 women would have been closer to their families and been in nicer prisons. Everyone knew that this was basically, like, another tactic to, like, you know, expand the prison system. And people on the outside rallied against it, and they finally defeated this. But this is a way in which prison systems and governments try to co-opt this language of, like, the need for improvement and, you know, like, the need for change to make the prison system stronger. So, in contrast, in 1976, the California Institution for Women established what they called an alternative program unit, which was basically a behavior modification or punishment unit for women who were seen as disruptive, you know, meaning that they were, you know, somehow outspoken against the prison system. They were being viewed as leaders. They were lesbians because, you know, like, one of the things I guess we forgot to talk about is the fact that you can't be a lesbian in prison. It's, like, against the rules. You get targeted much more when you're a lesbian, and if you're, you know, God forbid, caught, like, touching somebody, you could get, like, a sexual assault charge. They were, you know, women who were lesbians or women who just wouldn't follow the rules were sent to this behavior modification unit. And people on the outside rallied to get closed, and women on the inside also organized. And this resulted in the prison actually being forced to close down this unit and having to return all these other women to the general population. You know, and while it didn't, like, close the prison system, it ensured that, like, there wasn't a way for them to further control or repress women on the inside. So with that, I kind of wanted to, like, open it up to, like, ways that people thought that they could, that people on the outside can support women and other people on the inside without making the system bigger or stronger. Ideas?
How are people communicating what's going on when the prisoners are coming up with these ideas and need support? What outlets do they have to reach out to people on the outside who might be able to support them and put pressure on from the other direction?
In some places, there are, like, organized groups, like in California, you know, like, there's, like, the California Coalition for California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which actually has, like, a prisoner communication program where, like, they set up, you know, women in pen pals, you know, like, they actually go, they drive, like, the, like, 4 hours to the women's prison in the middle of nowhere, and they, like, do visit, you know, so basically there is, like, an open line of communication, and it's also building relationships with women in prison. There are some other groups that do, you know, like, support work for, you know, either individual prisoners or groups of prisoners, you know, as well. So, like, having, like, lines of communication open. Also, there are groups in other states, too, that are escaping my mind that, like, also do work specifically with women incarcerated in, like, certain areas, so that, like, there are ways to communicate when something is about to happen, as opposed to, like, it just being sort of like, oh, we had this revolt and nobody knew about it.
Yes. I don't know if you know about this, and I know we're kind of focused on, like, the United States, but all the Vipassana meditations that they conducted at prisons in India and how it totally, like, revolutionized the relationships between inmates and guards, and it was, like, the first time they'd ever tried something like that, and now they're considering extending it because it was, like, it's, like, a 10-day thing where nobody speaks, and the guards are doing it with the inmates, and people just meditate, and, like, all this crazy stuff was happening that was really, really positive, and at the end of it, they filmed some of it. They had, like, guards and inmates crying and hugging, like, people were really understanding each other, and it was, like, not a typical thing at all to happen. But and in India, where some of these people were there for 5 years still waiting for it to be sentenced, because they weren't even found guilty of anything yet, because the prison system in India is so terrible, and you're just kind of waiting for years and years to see a judge. I don't know. That's a really awesome thing, I think, that's happening.
Yeah. Other ideas? Yeah?
I had to write a paper that I chose to just, like, develop one time, and I'm really looking for insight on this idea, in that a lot of people need rides to prison and to court,
yes.
And also, therefore, a lot of people need childcare when they're going to do that.
Yes.
And so I had an idea, especially in this, like, market period with housing, that there were childcare facilities set up that had, like, Cory-checked volunteers or staff.
Mm-hmm.
They could use, like, local communities to have, like, regular childcare to actually pay them to exist and pay the rent and whatnot, but then also having the facility of people there available to drive to and from prison and also do, like, just momentary childcare or just, like, childcare for the parent or the guardian of the incarcerated person while they're there.
Yes.
And I guess the issues that I've been thinking about with that are, like, how frequently people can actually go to visit, and if that's, like, relevant.
In a lot of places, in a lot of states, like, New York State is one of the few exceptions. Like, there's only, like, one or maybe two women's prisons, and they're really, really far from, like, the urban areas where most people from prison, you know, most people end up in prison. So, like, it could, you know, like, and even in New York State, like, you know, like, guards want friends to, like, send a woman to Albion, which is, like, by the freaking Canadian border. You know, if she's not, like, behaving herself. So a lot of times, family members and caretakers of children can't go visit because it's, like, a huge distance away, it's a huge expense, you know, like, if you don't have a car, if you don't have gas money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, a lot of times women will say that they can never receive a visit from their child, you know, because, like, they're so far away. But, like, having rides is, like, a huge thing because, again, when you look at who goes to prison, you know, like, it's usually the people, like, at the bottom of the economic ladder. And that means their family members and their, you know, communities at the bottom of the economic ladder and less able to, like, drive 9 hours and spend the night in a motel and, you know, like, be able to, like, visit the next day, you know, in the prison system. So, like, yeah, rides are, you know, huge. And, like, having childcare for, like, an overburdened caretaker is also a really good idea. Other ways? Okay, I asked some of the women, I wrote this book on resistance and organizing of incarcerated women, and I asked them, like, about ways that they thought that people on the outside could support women on the inside without making the prison system bigger or stronger, because I was like, well, I want to hear from you, like, what do you think, you know, like, because we on the outside can come up with all sorts of ideas, and you might be like, eh, that's garbage, you know, like, we don't actually care about that issue, you know, do something that matters for us. But, like, you know, I also wanted them to be thinking about, like, not just something that helps in the immediate terms that can be then co-opted into expanding the prison system, but, like, ways in which we could sort of, like, have the long-term goal of, like, a world without prisons, you know, chipping away at how many people are going to prisons and are in prisons while focusing on the fact that people are still dying of, like, preventable things and people have all these other immediate needs that need to be addressed now. So they had a whole bunch of suggestions. And the first one, which was kind of overwhelming, was more contact with the women themselves, which is, like, you know, sort of goes back to what you're saying. It's like, how do they get the word out about what's going on inside prisons if there's no contact from the outside? One woman in Texas suggested women would do well with a mentor program, just to have someone in the world they can write to and ask questions of. Male is a strong motivator here. Another thing that they said was speaking out about these issues and connecting them with other struggles. So there are intersections between prison issues and, like, every other social justice issue. Like, so if you, like, primarily work around housing, you know, like, there's so many ways that, you know, prisons intersect with housing. Like, the fact that if you have a felony conviction, oftentimes you can't get, you know, like, government-subsidized housing or low-income housing. You know, landlords don't want to rent to people with felony convictions in some cases. Like, in New York City, if you get out of prison and you want to go stay at grandma's house and she lives in New York City Housing Authority, NYCHA housing, you could get her evicted if you even spend the night on her floor because she's not allowed, people in NYCHA housing are not allowed to have people with drug felonies or maybe it's any felonies, like, in their houses.
So it's kind of like you get out of prison, and again, you're, you know, coming from that bottom of the economic ladder, and you're like, yeah, grandma said I could stay on her floor. But it's like, oh, wait, I could get grandma evicted. Never mind, I guess I'll be homeless and end up in, you know, what passes as a shelter system. You know, or education. Like, why do we have an island devoted to, like, pretrial detainment that's Rikers Island, and why are our schools such shit? And why do our schools, for example, jails? You know, it's sort of like there's all sorts of, you know, intersections between whatever issue you're passionate about and incarceration. So kind of see where those intersections are so that you don't have to take on a whole new issue. But like, you know, like how can you like sort of bring that conversation into what you're already doing? Writing articles for those of you who are writers, or publishing theirs for those of you who are like sort of other media makers. You can expand this to any other type of media that you're doing. You know, sort of like getting the word out about this more. You know, so it's not just like this like thing in the corner, which is like, oh yeah, there's some women in prison over there. There's over 114,000 women in prison, you know, but like you don't hear anything about these issues. Sending in literature and news of the outside world. People in prison are hugely isolated from the outside world, you know, and so there are like several ways to do it. If you're connecting already with somebody in prison, you know, like print out the news off the internet, you know, like send them news about what's going on. Send them news about resistance too, because like, you know, like if they get the newspaper, they're not hearing about like, you know, like, you know, like student walkouts and student budget cuts and what people are doing to like organize around different things. They're hearing about, you know, about sports or, you know, whatever.
Is there a way to know the different filtering systems that the authorities in prisons use when you send them news? Or like,
I would communicate with the individual person,
okay,
you know, because like some of them, and also talk to me afterwards, you know, like about like if you have some questions about specific things.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes they're, it's like prison by prison, and sometimes it's like person by person. Like I was in communication with one woman who was organizing, and she was in a solitary confinement unit, and she was, everybody else could get books. And for some reason, the lieutenant one day decided, told her that she'd gotten a bunch of political books, and the lieutenant was like, you got a bunch of books, but Jesus told me that you can only get religious books. And she was like, well, where in the regulations does it say that I can only get religious books? And there was nothing in the regulations, but the lieutenant in charge of the mail said that Jesus had told her that she couldn't get these books because they weren't religious books. So like, again, it's sort of like, there's a system, you know, like there's systematic things, and then there's like the individual things, where it's like, this lieutenant obviously wanted to mess with this woman who was trying to organize. And was like, okay, one of the ways I'm going to mess with it is to tell you that, like, you know, you can't get these books now. So, again, it's sort of like system by system and then maybe person by person, too.
The books to prisons programs, which are all
yes.
over, usually have really good information
yes.
on.
And there's also
prison.
A books through bars table in the main tabling room, so you should definitely go, and I forgot to grab flyers
mm-hmm.
from them, and, like, pick the flyer and figure out, like, how you can, like, if you've got books, which most of us do, you know, like, think about, like, what are you really not going to read again, and, like, what could be of use to somebody in prison, you know, because, again, it's like, these are people who are totally cut off from like, the outside world, and especially news of like resistance and activism and actions on the outside world. Helping to establish programs that aren't used to disguise the problems in the prison system. So, you know, like programs that actually matter to people. Things that like bring their humanity back. Not just like, I'm gonna teach you how to make arts and crafts out of popsicle sticks, but you know, like way, like programs that actually like matter. So like, you know, the meditation program that kind of like brings people back to like the fact that they are humans, they're not cattle, they're not sheep, they're not, you know, some sort of animal that you stick in a cage, you know, but the fact that, like, you know, like, they are people. In the 1970s, there was a group called the Santa Cruz Women's Prison Project that set up the first ever university course for women incarcerated women in the country, and they realized that women needed programming that mattered. So they actually drove the, like, you know, like 4 hours to the women's prison every weekend, and they set up this thing where they basically taught women, they talked about, like, you know, like women of color issues, they talked about women in law, women in drug use, women in drug policy, and they had courses that actually mattered and were relevant to the women inside. And it sort of revolutionized the way that women thought of education as well, because they were like, wait a minute, you know, education is not just us reading a bunch of, like, dead white men. You know, it's like, this is stuff that is relevant to our lives and that we can then use on the outside. And it also helped shape their ways of, like, looking at the problem as not, I did something bad and I had to be taken away and, like, stuck in the cell and abused, but, like, there's a systemic problem both inside and outside. Like, why are so many women of us here, women of color? Why are so many of us poor? Why are so many of us in here for, you know, nonviolent drug and property offenses? So programs that kind of, like, start work start working to like counter this idea that like only bad people end up in prison because they did bad things. And also, peer education groups really need up-to-date information on health issues and treatment. So for any of you guys that might be involved in like health, you know, related, you know, activism, because a lot of times, like even at like groups like the Books to Prisoners and the Books Through Bars groups, like the information that gets donated is really out of date. And it's not good to send stuff that's really out of date to people in prison, because then they like have this information that, you know, might have actually been countered by, you know, something else. So they also need people on the outside who are willing to provide services that are much needed but not available in prisons, like drug treatment programs, like, you know, like ways that like people can sort of like, you know, like be healthy and be whole while, you know, still incarcerated. And then, because we're in New York State, I wanted to like point out a couple of things that have been done by people on the outside. So as I said before, like New York State was like the sixth or the ninth, you know, state to pass a law against shackling women, you know, who are in labor, you know, so that happened last year. So, like, there was a lot of work by former women prisoners and advocates and supporters on the outside that said, you know what, we don't want women to be shackled, you know, and that results in this bill being passed. In April 2009, the Rockefeller drug laws were reformed. They weren't totally abolished, so, you know, you can still get, like, a huge amount of time for possessing narcotics, but it restored the judge's discretion for first and second time drug offenses. So if it was your first drug offense or your second drug offense, you know, it allowed the judge to have a little bit more leeway and you didn't automatically get like a long prison sentence. And it allowed some people to apply for resentencing under the drug laws, and it allocated $70 million in funding for alternatives to incarceration and drug treatment programs. So, you know, like while it's not like getting rid of these mandatory sentences, it is like, you know, a reform that actually can impact people's lives in a more positive way. And then there's a couple of things that are still being done. There's something called the Expanded Discretion Bill for the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which basically would grant foster care agencies the discretion to delay filing papers for the termination of parental rights. And across the country, if a child has been in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state has to move to terminate parental rights. And so the Ask for Expanded Discretion Bill would basically say that if the reason why this child is in foster care is because the parent is incarcerated or in an inpatient drug treatment program, the social workers can delay filing these papers. So it's not an automatic, like, you've hit month 15, you know, too bad, so sad, you've lost your child. And it passed in the state assembly, but our lovely Mayor Bloomberg is opposing this, you know. And it's also being opposed by the New York Public Welfare Association and ACS, which is like our like child welfare services thing, because ACS runs our foster care system as well, you know, in which, I don't know how many of you know, but like foster care parents get paid to like take care of kids, you know, and oftentimes like they don't take very good care of kids. Like there have been all these stories that have come out about like crappy foster families. So that's like still being worked on. And I mean, even though I don't have a lot of faith, like being an anarchist and abolitionist in policy, I also recognize that sometimes you need these like policy changes to happen to, like, you know, like at least keep it from being like a devastated community, like more devastation happening. And then there's also the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, which would expand judicial discretion and permit judges to sentence domestic violence survivors who have committed crimes as a result of abuse, either like kill their partners in self-defense, or, you know, like done something because they were being abused and they were forced into this, to shorter prison terms. So instead of, you know, like the woman being sentenced to like a longer term for her spouse killing their children, you know, like getting shorter prison terms, or, you know, being sentenced to an alternative to incarceration program. You know, so instead of punishing survivors of abuse more for being abused, you know, actually recognizing that like this is a factor in why they did what they did. And this is also important because parole boards are not mandated to consider the effects of long in the United States. So you can go before a parole board and they don't actually have to consider the fact that like you've had a history of abuse, like when you did something. And because there's people coming in for the next workshop, I'm going to end with a quote from Rachel, who is incarcerated in Colorado for something her boyfriend did. And I usually don't ask about things, but like I sort of wanted to throw that out there as like somebody who served, she's a young woman serving a really long sentence for something that her boyfriend did, you know, and like, again, sort of like that idea that you're responsible, you know, like somehow women are more responsible, you know, comes into play in her case. And when I asked her, how do you think that people on the outside can support women on the inside without making the system bigger or stronger, she said, I was thinking about how we prisoners are very cut off from much of the rest of the world, including people who do not support the prison system or people who may be interested in our struggle. So I think that more communication via letters would help. I think that transaction would encourage resistance on both ends because it would strengthen information and knowledge both ways. I also think that hearing about efforts of resistance outside of prison would inspire and encourage us prisoners. Plus, through correspondence with prisoners, people can see that many incidents that they read or hear about happen daily, and it will really legitimize things. The communication between two humans concerning their hopes, ideas, and their plights is what allows them to bond in resistance against a system that affects everyone in many different ways. As I mentioned, we prisoners would be inspired to see another position of struggle, and that, though they may differ, all struggles are shared. This would strengthen resistance both inside and outside of the prison gates. Thanks.
I will be father.
Huh?
I will be father.